he muttered. "Is that a Scottish curse?" she asked, and sat up straighter, the handkerchief still twisted in her hands. "Perhaps I should find it easier to say bad words in another language."
"Nay, Gaelic cursing's a different thing. It's... well, you make a curse for the occasion, you might say. We really didn't have bad words, but you might say something like, 'May worms breed in your belly and choke you on your way out.'"
"That's no a very good one," he said apologetically. "Just on the spur of the moment, Ken."
"Uncle Jimmy can turn a curse would curl your hair without even thinking about it, but I'm no that good."
She made a small ha sound that wasn't close to a laugh, but wasn't crying either.
"What was that thee said then?" she asked after a moment's silence.
"In Gaelic."
"Oh, Mac na Gaelic. That's just son of a bitch. Something you might say by way of description, maybe. Or if you can't think of anything better to say, and you have to say something, or bust."
"Mac na Gaelic, then," she said, and fell silent.
"Thee need not stay with me," she added, after a few moments. "Dinna be daft," he said amiably, and they sat together for some time.
Until the back door opened, and the black form of a man on crutches showed for a moment against the light. The door closed, and Ian stood up.
"God bless thee, Sylvia," he said softly, and squeezed her shoulder briefly in farewell. He didn't, of course, go far, only into the shadows under a nearby larch. "Sylvia," Gabriel called, peering into the dark. "Is thee here? Mrs. Brant said thee had gone out."
"I am here," she said. Her tone was perfectly neutral, and Ian thought it had cost her quite a bit to make it so. Her husband stumped through the hay-strewn mud to the target tree and bent to peer at her in the shadow.
"May I sit down?" he asked.
"No," she said. "Say what thee must." He snorted briefly, but laid his crutches on the ground and straightened up.
"Well, then, I wish the girls to remain here. They wish this too," he added after a pause.
"Of course they do," she said, her voice colourless. "They love thee. They have constant hearts. They still love thee. Did thee tell them that thee has married again, that thee has another family?" There was silence, and after a moment of it she laughed bitterly. "And did thee tell them that thee would have nothing to do with their sister? Or has thee changed thy mind regarding chastity?"
"Has thee changed thy mind regarding our marriage? I can have two wives, as I said. Perhaps thee could find a place nearby where thee could live with the child, and Prudence and Patience would be able to visit. And I, of course," he added.
"I have not changed my mind," she said, her voice cold as the night. "I will not be thy concubine, nor will I let Patience and Prudence remain here."
"I am far from rich, but I will manage the expense," he began.
But she cut him off, leaping to her feet, visible now in the faint light from the house.
"Damn the expense," she said, furious. "After what thee said, thee expects that I will—" "What did I say?" he demanded. "If I spoke out of shock—"
"Thee said I was a whore."
"I did not use that word."
"Thee didn't have to. Thy meaning was clear enough."
"I didn't mean—"
Gabriel began, and she rounded on him, eyes blazing.
"Oh, but thee did mean it.
And whatever thee says now, thee would still mean it. If I were to go to thy bed, thee would wilt from thinking of the men who had come before thee, and be consumed with yet more anger against me for causing thy disgrace." She snorted, steam rising sudden from her nostrils. "And thee would wonder whether those men were preferable to thee. Worry, did I think of any of them when I touched thy body? Did I think thee weak and disgusting?"
"I know thee, Gabriel Hardman, and by this time I know a good deal about other men too." "And thee dares. Thee dares." She was shouting now, and could be heard from the barn, surely. Thee dares to tell me it's godly and acceptable that thee should take more than one woman to thy bed, only because thee lives with folk who do such things?
Gabriel was pale with anger, but had himself under control. He wanted his daughters.
I apologize for what I said,
he said, between clenched teeth.
I spoke out of shock. How can thee blame me for speaking wildly?
Thee was not speaking wildly when thee said thee would take prudence and patience from me, she replied.
I am their father, and I will keep them.
No, thee will not, she said evenly, and turned toward Ian's tree.
Will he?
Ian stepped out from behind the tree.
No, he said mildly, he won't.
Gabriel licked his lips and huffed out a great white sigh.
What are we to do then, Sylvia?
He said, plainly struggling for calm.
Thee knows the girls want to be with me as much as I wish to be with them. Whatever thee thinks of me at present, how can thee be so heartless as to take them from me?
As for thee, I expect thy other children will comfort thee, Sylvia said, in as nasty a tone as Ian had ever heard from her.
She rubbed a hand over her face, hard, also striving for calm.
No, thee is right in that, at least.
I do know how much they love thee, and I will never say anything to them that would blacken thee in their eyes.
I think thee should tell them, though, about thy children here. They will understand that, but they will not understand why thee would keep the truth from them. And they are bound to find out sooner or later, though not from me.
Gabriel had moved into the light as well, shuffling his lame foot. He had assumed an odd mottled appearance, like an old birch tree whose bark is peeling off.
I will not go and leave them here, Sylvia said, having regained some control of her emotions. But I will write to thee when we have found a home, and thee may come to visit them. I will help them to write to thee, and perhaps they may come here to see thee again, if it seems safe.
She straightened her back and smoothed her pinafore.
I forgive thee, Gabriel, she said quietly, but I will never be wife to thee again.
Chapter 89 The Filature Savannah, September the 30th, 1779.
Alfred Brumby didn't look like a smuggler, or at least not like Brianna's notion of one. On the other hand, she was forced to admit that the only people she knew who were, or had been, professional smugglers were her father and Fergus. Mr. Brumby was a comfortably solid and beautifully dressed gentleman of medium height, who, upon meeting her, had tilted his head back, shading his eyes as he looked up at her, and then laughed and bowed to her.
"I see that Lord John knows the value of a good artist," he said, smiling. "Do you scale your commissions by the inch, madam? Because if so, I may be obliged to sell my carriage in order to afford you."
"I do indeed charge by the inch, sir," she told him politely, and nodded at his diminutive wife. "But the basis would be the size of the painting rather than the artist."
He laughed heartily, and so had his very young wife.
My God, Brianna thought, she's barely 18, if that.
And then had turned to Roger, shaking hands and engaging him in lively conversation, while his wife, Angelina, knelt on the floor, careless of her fine dress, and talked to Mandy and Jem, then scrambled to her feet and invited them to come along and see their mother's studio. The arrangement offered by the hospitable Mr. Brumby was that the Mackenzies would live in his household during the length of Brianna's commission and be treated as members of the family. By supper time, everyone had been seamlessly absorbed into the Brumby household, which was a large and cheerful one, with many servants, an excellent cook, and Henrika, a large and very capable German maidservant who had been Angelina's nurse and had insisted upon coming with her upon her marriage to Mr. Brumby.
"And how do you propose to pass your time, Mr. Mackenzie, while your wife is employed in painting?"
Mr. Brumby asked over a delicious pork roast with brandied applesauce.
I have various commissions to fulfil, sir, Roger said, on behalf of the Presbytery of Charlestown, who have entrusted me with various letters to deliver, and also a few small errands to perform on behalf of my father-in-law, Colonel Fraser.
Oh, indeed!
Mr. Brumby's eyes grew bright through his spectacles.
I've heard of Colonel Fraser, as who has not?
I was unaware that he makes whiskey of such quality, though. He nodded at the bottle Roger had presented to him before dinner. He'd brought it along to the table and continued to take small sips from a silver cup that the butler replenished frequently in the course of the meal.
Should he be interested in selling it to a wider market?
Roger smiled and assured Mr. Brumby that Jamie made whiskey only for his own personal use, causing Mr. Brumby to laugh loudly and give Roger an exaggerated wink and a finger alongside his nose.
Very sensible, he said. Very sensible indeed. Customs and excise taxes being what they are, it would hardly pay to offer it commercially, save at an extortionate price, and that, of course, has its own difficulties.
Brianna enjoyed the dinner and was delighted by the house, which had been built by a fine architect. The effort of nodding appreciatively at each of the Brumbies in turn, for both of them talked incessantly and frequently at the same time, was wearing her down, though, and she took the entrance of cigars and brandy for the gentleman as her cue to rise and excuse herself, to go and see that the children were still where she'd put them. They had been tucked into trundle beds that had been set up in the commodious dressing room attached to the well-appointed guest room that had been assigned to the Mackenzies, and when looked in upon, they were both clean and sound asleep, having been fed earlier by the cook, Mrs. Upton.
I could get used to this, Roger said, yawning as he came in later, stripping off his coat. You wouldn't think there was an armed siege going on outside, would you?
The Brumby's house stood in Reynolds Square, opposite the filature, a facility for raising silkworms, and the plentitude of trees, including the large grove of white mulberry trees required for the diet of said silkworms, gave it a sense of enclosure and pastoral peace.
You're keeping track of the calendar, aren't you?
Bree pulled her sleeping shift over her head, noting from the smell that she should talk to the Brumby's laundress tomorrow.
How many days until all hell breaks loose?
Less than 3 weeks, he said more soberly. Your father didn't give much detail on the battle, but we know the Americans will lose. The siege will be lifted on October the 11th.
And you'll be here and safely inside, right?
She raised her eyebrows at him, and he smiled and took her hand.
I will,
he said, and kissed it. Chapter 90 The Swamp Fox, Savannah, October the 8th, 1779. Roger had dressed for his occasions. Luckily, the same black broadcloth suit, long-coated and pewter-buttoned, would do for both, since it was the only one he possessed. Brianna had plaited and clubbed his hair severely, and he was so clean-shaven that his jaw felt raw. A high white stock, wrapped around his neck, completed the picture, he hoped, of a respectable clergyman. The British sentries at the barricade on White Bluff Road had given him no more than a disinterested glance before nodding him through. He could only hope the American sentries outside the city felt the same lack of curiosity about ministers. He rode out a good distance from the city before turning east and beginning to circle back toward the Americans' siege lines, and it was just past noon when he came within sight of them. The American camp was rough but orderly, an acre or so of canvas tents fluttering in the wind like trapped gulls, and the amazingly big French warships visible in the river beyond, from which, every so often, a volley of cannon fire would erupt with gouts of flame, setting loose vast clouds of white smoke to drift across the marshes with the scattered clouds of gulls and oyster catchers, alarmed by the noise. There were pickets posted among the yaupon bushes,
one of whom popped up like a jack-in-the-box and pointed a musket at Roger in a businesslike way. Halt! Roger pulled in his reins and raised his stick, white handkerchief tied to its end, feeling foolish. It worked, though. The picket whistled through his teeth for a companion, who popped up alongside, and at the first man's nod, came forward to take his horse's bridle.
"What's your name, and what do you want?"
the man demanded, squinting up at Roger. He wore a backwoodsman's ordinary breeches and hunting shirt, but had army boots and an odd uniform cap shaped like a squashed bishop's mitre. A copper badge on his collar read Sergeant Bradford.
"My name is Roger Mackenzie. I'm a Presbyterian minister, and I've brought a letter to General Lincoln from General James Fraser, late of General Washington's Monmouth Command."
Sergeant Bradford's brows rose out of sight beneath his hat.
"General Fraser," he said, "Monmouth. That's the fellow that abandoned his troops to tend his wife."
This was said in a derisive tone, and Roger felt the words like a blow to the stomach.
Was this how Jamie's admittedly dramatic resignation of his commission was commonly perceived in the Continental Army? If so, his own present mission might be a little more delicate than he'd expected. "General Fraser is my father-in-law, sir," Roger said in a neutral voice, "an honourable man, and a very brave soldier."
The look of scorn didn't quite leave the man's face, but it moderated into a short nod, and the man turned away, jerking his chin in an indication that Roger might follow if he felt so inclined. General Lincoln's tent was a large but well-worn green canvas, with a flagstaff outside from which the red and white stripes of the Grand Union flag fluttered in the wind off the water. Sergeant Bradford muttered something to the guard at the entrance and left Roger with a curt nod.
"The Reverend Mackenzie, is it?" the guard said, looking him up and down with an air of scepticism. "And a letter from General James Fraser. Have I got that right?" Christ, did Jamie know of the talk about him?
Roger remembered the moment's hesitation when Jamie had handed him the letter. Perhaps he did then.
"I am. It is. And you do," Roger said firmly. "Is General Lincoln able to receive me?"
He'd been meaning to leave the letter and come back for the reply, if there was one, after he'd spoken to Francis Marion, but now he thought he'd better find out whether Benjamin Lincoln shared this apparent negative view of Jamie's actions.
"Wait here."
The soldier, he was a Continental regular, a uniformed corporal, dug under the tent flap, kept closed against the chilly breeze. Through the momentary gap, Roger caught sight of a large man in uniform curled up on a cot, his broad blue back turned to the door. A faint buzzing snore reached Roger's ears, but apparently the corporal had no intention of trying to wake General Lincoln, and after a minute's delay, for the sake of plausibility, Roger assumed, the corporal reappeared.
"I'm afraid the general's engaged at present, Mr.
Reverend," Roger repeated firmly. "The Reverend Roger Mackenzie. As General Lincoln isn't available, could I speak with... shit, what's Marion's rank now? With Captain Francis Marion, perhaps?"
"Lieutenant Colonel Marion, I expect you mean," the corporal corrected him matter-of-factly.
"You'll maybe find him out by the Jewish cemetery. I saw him go that way with some chasseur a while ago. You know where it is?"
He gestured toward the west.
"I'll find it. Thank you."
The guard seemed relieved to be rid of him, and Roger made his way in the direction indicated, holding his broad-brimmed hat against the tug of the wind. The busy atmosphere of the camp was much at odds with the brief vision of its sleeping commander. Men were moving to and fro with purpose. In the distance he saw a great many horses. Cavalry, he realized with interest. What were they doing?
Forming up.
He felt as though Jamie had spoken in his ear, matter-of-fact as always, and his stomach contracted.
Getting ready.
This was October the 8th. According to Frank Randall's book, the Siege of Savannah began on September the 16th and would be lifted on October the 11th.
For all the good that's likely to do you, blockhead. For the thousandth time he castigated himself for not knowing more, not having read everything there was to read about the American Revolution. But knowing, even as he reproached himself, that the chances of any book knowledge ever resembling the reality of his experience was vanishingly small. A small squadron of pelicans dropped low in unison over the distant water and sailed serenely just above the waves, ignoring ships, cannon, horses, shouting men, and the rapidly clouding sky.
Must be nice, he thought, watching them. Nothing to think about but where your next fish is coming.
A musket went off somewhere behind him. A cloud of feathers burst from one of the pelicans, and it dropped like a stone, wings loose, into the water. Cheers and whistles came from behind him. These cut off abruptly by a furious officer's voice castigating the marksman for wasting ammunition.
Okay, point taken.
As though backing up the rifleman, there was a distant boom followed by another.
Siege cannon, he thought,
and an uncontrollable shiver of excitement ran down his spine at the thought.
Getting the range.
He lost his way briefly, but a passing corporal put him on the right path and came with him to the cemetery, marked by a large stone gateway.
That'll be Colonel Marion, Reverend, his escort said and pointed. When you've done your business with him, one of his men'll bring you back to General Lincoln's tent.
The man turned to go, but then turned back to add a caution.
Don't you be a-wandering about by yourself, Reverend. 'Tisn't safe, and don't try to leave the camp either. Pickett's got orders to shoot any man as tries to leave without a pass from General Lincoln.
No, Roger said, I won't.
But the corporal hadn't waited for an answer. He was hurrying back into the main body of the camp, boots crunching on white oyster shell.
It was close, a lot closer than he'd thought.
He could feel the whole camp humming, a sense of nervous energy, men making ready.
But surely it was too early for...
Then he walked through the high stone gate of the cemetery, its lintel decorated with the Star of David, and saw at once what must be Lieutenant Colonel Francis Marion, hat in hand, and a blue and buff uniform coat thrown loose over his shoulders, deep in conversation with three or four other officers. The unfortunate word that popped into Roger's mind was marionette. Francis Marion was what Jamie would call a wee man, standing no more than 5'4", by Roger's estimation, scrawny and spindle-shanked, with a very prominent French nose. Not quite what the romantic moniker Swamp Fox conjured up. His appearance was made more arresting by a novel tonsorial arrangement, featuring thin strands of hair combed into a careful puff atop a balding pate, and two rather larger puffs on either side of his head, like earmuffs. Roger was consumed by curiosity as to what the man's ears must look like to require this sort of disguise, but he dismissed this with an effort of will and waited patiently for the lieutenant colonel to finish his business.
Chasseurs, the corporal had said. French troops, then. And they looked it, very tidy in blue coats with green facings and white small clothes, with jaunty yellow feather cockades sticking up from the front of their cocked hats. Like 4th of July sparklers.
They were also undeniably speaking French, lots of them, at once. On the other hand, they were black, which he hadn't expected at all. Marion raised a hand, and most of them stopped speaking, though there was a good deal of shifting from foot to foot and a general air of impatience. He leaned forward, speaking up into the face of an officer who topped him by a good 6 inches, and the others stopped fidgeting and craned to listen. Roger couldn't hear what was being said, but he was strongly aware of the electric current running through the group. It was the same current he'd sensed running through the camp, but stronger.
Jesus Christ Almighty, they're getting ready to fight. Now!
He'd never been on a live battlefield, but had walked a few historical ones with his father. The Reverend Wakefield had been a keen war historian and a good storyteller. He'd been able to evoke the sense of a muddled, panicked flight from the open ground at Sheriff Muir and the sense of doom and slaughter from the haunted earth of Culloden.
Roger was getting much the same feeling rising up from the quiet earth of the cemetery through his body, and he curled his fists, urgently wanting the feel of a weapon in his hand. The air was cool but humid, with a faint rumble of thunder over the sea, and sweat was condensing on his body. He saw Marion wipe his own face with a large, grubby handkerchief, then tuck it away with an impatient gesture, and step closer to the chasseur officer, raising his voice and jerking his head toward the river behind them. Whatever he'd said, he was speaking French, and the distance was too far for Roger to make out more than a phrase here and there, seemed to settle the chasseur, who grunted and nodded amongst themselves, then gathered behind their officer and set off at a jog trot toward the ships. Marion watched them go, then sighed visibly and sat down on one of the tombstones. It seemed ludicrous to approach Marion with his questions under these circumstances, but the man had spotted him and lifted his chin inquiringly. Not much choice but to say hello, at least.
"Good afternoon, sir," he said, bowing slightly. "I apologize for interrupting you. I can see that..."
Lacking any sufficient words, he waved a hand toward the distant camp. Marion laughed, a low sound of honest amusement.
"Well, yes," he said,
in an accent that seemed faintly tinged with the French he'd just been speaking.
"It's clear, isn't it? I take it you didn't know, though, or..."
One eyebrow quirked up.
"Or I wouldn't be here,"
Roger finished. Marion shrugged.
"You might have come to volunteer. The Continental Army isn't choosy, though I have to say that the occasional minister we get usually doesn't wear his best clothes to fight in."
The look of amusement deepened as he looked Roger up and down.
"So why are you here, sir?" "My name is Roger Mackenzie, and I am the son-in-law of General James Fraser, late of..." "Really?"
Both eyebrows were raised as high as they could go.
"Fraser sent you as an envoy to General Lincoln, and they sent you to me because Benjamin's asleep?" "Not exactly," he'd best just put it boldly.
Whatever Jamie's reputation with the Continental Army was, his business with Marion was straightforward enough.
"I take it you know that General Fraser resigned his commission following the Battle of Monmouth, yes?"
Marion shifted his scrawny buttocks on the stone.
"Everyone knows by now, I should think. Is it true that he wrote his letter of resignation on the back of an ensign and sent in to Lee with a muddy shirt?" "It was written in his wife's blood," Roger said, "but yes."
That took the look of amusement out of Marion's eyes. He nodded a little, the meagre puff of greying hair on top of his head stirring in the rising breeze as though disturbed by the thoughts beneath it.
"I don't know Monsieur Fraser as a man," he said, "but I've talked with those who do."
He eyed Roger, head on one side.
"What does he want with me?" "He's assembling a militia,"
Roger replied just as bluntly,
"a partisan band. He doesn't want to have anything further to do with the Continental Army, and I imagine the feeling is mutual. But he does intend to fight." "I suppose he'll have to."
It was a statement of fact, made with no emotion at all, but spoken here, with the air around them live and as dangerous as a lightning storm. It struck Roger like a blow in the chest.
"Yes. And he wants a liaison with the army, perhaps. A connection, but not a formal connection."
"Just so." Marion's lips were thin and bloodless. Pressed tight together, they disappeared, making him look like a marionette with a hinged, carved jaw.
"He knows of you, too," Roger said carefully, "that you have experience in forming militia units and employing them effectively in a formal military context." "It's much more effective to employ them outside that context," Marion said, glancing toward the cemetery wall.
There was a rising noise of horses and men, audible now that the guns had fallen silent. His large dark eyes turned back, focusing on Roger's face.
"Tell him that. He should keep his distance from the army. They will use his militia, certainly. They need every man they can get. But the risk to him personally, is very great.
If it had not been for Lee's trial and Lafayette's good word, Fraser would have been court-martialed himself after Monmouth, perhaps even hanged. Marion spoke casually, but Roger felt the scar on his throat tighten and burn beneath the concealment of his high white stock, and he had the sudden uncontrollable urge to fling his arms out, burst the memory of rope and helplessness. He gulped air and tried to speak, but no words came. Instead, he turned violently on his heel, seized a stone from the ground and flung it at the stone wall. It struck with a crack like a bullet, and a gull that had been sitting on the wall rose with a shriek and flapped away, dropping a large wet splatter of feces on the ground between the two men. Marion looked at him with concern. Roger cleared his throat and spat on the ground. He didn't apologize. There wasn't anything he could say.
"I'll tell him,"
he said, hoarse and formal.
"Thank you for your advice, sir."
He was trembling. The sense of something coming hadn't gone away. It was growing. The ground seemed to be vibrating, but it must be only him. A young lieutenant came through the gate beneath the Star of David, face lit with fear and excitement.
"They're waiting for you, Colonel."
Marion nodded to the boy and stood up.
"You can't leave, I'm afraid," he said apologetically to Roger. "It will begin soon. Do you want to fight? I can give you a good rifle."
No.
Roger touched the stock at his throat. Marion's attention was focused on the sounds behind the cemetery wall. No, it wasn't his imagination. The ground was vibrating. Horses. The horses.
"But I'd like to help if I can."
"Bon," said Marion softly, almost absently. He slid his arms into the sleeves of his coat and hitched it up on his shoulders, fingers twitching the lower buttons into place without looking. But his attention came back to Roger just for a moment.
"Go back into camp, then," he said, "and wait. If things go wrong, you can help bury us. Or if they go right, I expect."
Marion looked toward the gate and shook his head slightly.
"I don't have a good feeling about this, no,"
he said as though to himself, and went off, the young lieutenant falling at a step behind him. Roger hesitated for a split second, then followed, stretching his legs to catch up.
"I'm no good with a rifle," he said, "but if you can give me a sword, I'll go with you."
Marion cast him the briefest of glances, nodded, and made a small gesture to the lieutenant.
"Bon,"
he said.
"Come on, then."
Chapter 91. Besieged. Brianna was cutting up a bit of fried chicken in the kitchen for Mandy when she heard a tapping at the window. She looked up in surprise to see Lord John outside in uniform. He grimaced and nodded, indicating that he would like to come in out of the rain. "What are you doing out here?" she asked, opening the door into the back garden. She'd had tea with him twice since their arrival, but hadn't expected an informal visit.
"I wanted to see you for a moment," he replied, stepping in and taking the towel she offered him. "But I can't spare the time for civilities with Mr. or Mrs. Brumby. Thank you, my dear."
He took off his hat, wiped his face, and brushed at the shoulders of his blue cloak, then handed back the towel.
"I came to tell you that the siege will shortly be at an end," he said carefully, glancing at Jem, Mandy, and Mrs. Upton, the cook.
"Really? That's..." She stopped abruptly, seeing his face.
"What makes you think so?"
she asked carefully, and he gave her a brief smile.
"The Americans have begun to move their guns," he said.
"Oh, have they? Time enough," Mrs. Upton said, eyes on the eggs she was whisking. "The master said as he thought the Frenchies and their ships would be off soon. They not waiting to be blown to bits by hurricanes."
"Hurricanes?" said Jem, perking up. "Do they have hurricanes here?"
"Indeed we do, Master Jem," Mrs. Upton said, nodding portentously at the rain-spattered window. "See that rain? You can tell how hard the wind's blowing. See the drops run slantwise down the glass? This time of the year the wind comes up, and sometimes it doesn't go back down for days.
I know you haven't much time, Bree said, eyeing John, but come along to my studio, will you? I'd like your opinion on something.
It would be my pleasure. Bonsoir, monsieur, mademoiselle.
He nodded to Jemmy, then solemnly picked up Mandy's chubby hand, fork, chicken and all, bowed over it, and planted a discreet kiss upon it that made her shriek and giggle.
Mrs. Upton is correct to a point, he said to Bree, once they were safely down the hall. D'Estaing does not want to lose half his fleet to a hurricane, but neither does he want to sail away without trying to get what he came for.
Meaning?
Meaning that the Americans are indeed moving their smaller guns, but not back onto the ships. A large number of troops appear to be moving to the south of the town, circling round through the marshes, which is not something I personally would do, but styles of command vary.
She'd clenched her hands without noticing. Now she noticed and unclenched them with a small effort.
You mean they're going to try to take the city now?
They'll certainly try, he assured her. I don't think they'll manage it, but they have quite a few more men than we do, which no doubt gives them a sense of optimism. Just in case.
He pushed back his cloak in order to reach into the haversack he had slung over his shoulder, and pulled out a small bundle of cloth, folded into a packet and tied with string.
It's an American flag, he said, handing it to her. Hal took it off a prisoner. If, and I do mean in the extremely unlikely event, the Americans do get in, hang this out of a window or tack it to the front door.
Roger.
She swallowed. He'd been going to visit an elderly retired Presbyterian minister who lived in the tiny settlement of Brian Neck. With luck, he was nowhere near Savannah at the moment. But he had mentioned maybe going to see Francis Marion on Jamie's behalf if the Swamp Fox should be in the American camp. But it wasn't supposed to be now. Her heart was beginning to thump erratically, and she put a hand on her chest to still it. They have more men, you said? He was resettling his cloak, ready to go, but looked up at this. How many?
Oh, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000, he said, at a guess.
And how many do you have?
Not that many, he said, but we are His Majesty's army. We know how to do this sort of thing.
He smiled, and rising slightly on his toes, kissed her cheek.
Don't worry, my dear. If anything drastic happens, I'll come for you if I can.
He had almost got to the back door before she shook off her sense of shock enough to run after him. Lord John? He turned at once, eyebrows raised, and she thought for an instant how young he looked, excited at the nearness of battle.
Roger.
Oh, Lord, Roger. My husband, she managed, breathless. He's on his way home from an errand. He thought he'd make it for supper. Lord John shook his head.
If he's not here now, he won't be.
He saw the look on her face and added,
I mean, he can't get into the city. The road is closed and the city is surrounded by abatis. But I'll send word to the captain of the city guard. Remind me, what's your husband's name and what does he look like?
Roger, she said through the lump in her throat. Roger Mackenzie. He's tall and dark and he looks like a Presbyterian preacher.
Thank God you wore your good clothes today, she thought passionately toward her absent husband.
Lord John had been fully concentrated on her words, but that made him smile.
In that case, I'm sure no one will shoot him, he said, and lifting her hand, kissed it briefly. Au revoir, my dear.
Good. She began by reflex, but then froze. He politely pretended not to notice, touched her cheek gently, then turned and went out, pulling down his hat against the rain. The soft light woke her next morning. She lay for a moment, confused.
What was wrong?
Mummy! Mummy!
A small, curly black head with bright brown eyes popped up at eye level, and she blinked, trying to focus.
Mummy!
Mrs. Upton says there's flapjacks and hash for breakfast. Hurry up.
Mandy vanished, and Bree heard both children thundering down the stairs, both evidently already dressed and shod. It was true. Enticing smells of food and coffee were drifting up from the dining room below. She sat up and swung her feet out of bed. And then it struck her. It was quiet. The guns had stopped. After 5 days of being jerked awake in the black pre-dawn by the distant French ships practicing bombardment, today the house was rising peacefully, early sun seeping through the fog, calm as honey. "Thank God," she muttered, and crossed herself with a quick prayer for Roger and another for her father, her first father. She'd believed what he'd said in the book. The siege of Savannah would fail. But it was hard to have complete faith in history when it was exploding around you. "Thanks, Daddy," she said, and reached for her stays. Chapter 92. Like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. In the marshes outside Savannah, an hour past midnight, October the 9th, 1779. The quill was little more than a blunt stub, the greasy feather mangled by dogged hands determined to send one last word. Roger had written more than one such word tonight for the men who could not write or had no notion what to say. Now the camp lay sleeping, lightly, all around him, and he faced the same problem. "Dearest Bree," he wrote, and paused for a breath before going on. There was only the one thing to say, and he wrote, "I'm sorry." But she deserved more, and slowly he found his way. "I didn't mean to be here, but I have the strongest feeling that here is where I should be. It wasn't quite, whom shall I send? Who shall go for us? But something close, and so was my answer. God willing, I'll see you soon. For now and for always, I am your husband, and I love you. Roger." The last few words were ghosts on the scrap of rough, rain-spotted paper, the last of the ink. His name was no more than scratches, but he supposed that was all right. She'd know who'd written it. He let the ink dry and folded the scrap carefully, then realized that he had no way to send it, nor any ink left with which to write Bree's direction on it. The other letters had been given to Marion's company clerk, now snoring under a blanket near one of the many watchfires, anonymous among the huddled sleeping sheep. With slow hands, he tucked it into the breast pocket of his coat. If he died in the morning, someone might find it on him. Francis Marion would survive this battle. Roger could trust him to send it on. To Jamie, at least. He lay down on the squelchy ground, commended his soul to God, and was asleep. 2 hours before dawn, October the 9th, 1779. There was a shimmer of light in the eastern sky, but fog lay so thickly on the marshes that the city wasn't visible. It was easy to believe that it wasn't there at all, that they'd lost their bearings in the dark, and were now facing inland away from Savannah. That when the order was given, they'd charge, yelling like banshees, straight out into peaceful farmland, startling sleeping cows and slaves at their work. But the wet, sluggish air stirred, and suddenly Roger caught the scent of baking bread from the public ovens in Savannah, faint, but so heady that his empty stomach growled. Brianna. She was there, somewhere in the fog with the fresh baked bread. Someone murmured something in French, too low to catch the words, but evidently witty, for there was a ripple of laughter, and the tension relaxed for a moment. They were bunched into columns now, four columns, each column 800 strong. There was no need to keep quiet. The British certainly knew they were here. He could hear shouts from one of the redoubts at the edge of the city now, echoing oddly in the fog. Spring Hill, they called it. There was another redoubt somewhere to the left, but he didn't remember what that one was called. It was cold so early, but sweat trickled down the side of his face, and he wiped it away, morning stubble rasping under his palm. The officers had all shaved before dawn, putting on their best uniforms like bullfighters preparing for the ring. But the men had risen from their blankets and bedsacks frowsty as scarecrows. Wide awake, though, and ready.
It's the wrong day. Surely it's the wrong day.
He shook his head violently. He was an historian, too, or had been. He, of all people, should know how imprecise history really was. But here they were, swallowed up in swirling fog, facing an invisible armed city at dawn. On the wrong day. He drew a deep, trembling breath.
We're going to lose this one.
Frank Randall said so. His stomach clenched, hunger forgotten.
Lord, help me do what you want me to do, but in the name of Christ your Son, let me live through it. Because if you don't, you'll have my wife to answer to,
he murmured, and touched the hilt of his borrowed sword. General Marion was bending down from his saddle, speaking French to two of the officers from Saint-Domingue. Murky as it was, he was close enough to see the bright yellow of the officers' lapels and cockades. Yellow-breasted sapsuckers, he thought. They might as well be, too, for as much of their speech as he understood. Theoretically, Roger spoke French, but he didn't speak this kind of French, full of hissing and glottal stops. No one was trying to be quiet. Everyone knew what was about to happen, including the British garrison. The Americans and their allies had given up their position before the city, and dragging their unwieldy cannon through the marshes in the dark, had circled Savannah, the army gathering again before the two points where they might break through the city's defences, south of the Louisville Road.
Lord, help them. Help me help them. Please deliver us.
And he knew it was a vain prayer, and still he prayed with all his heart.
Les abattis sont en feu.
He heard the shout above the rumble and murmur and clanking of the army and felt the jolt of hope like a stroke of lightning in his heart. Someone had managed to set the abattis on fire. The news was rocketing around the marshes, and Marion stood up in his stirrups to peer through the fog. Roger licked his lips, tasting salt. The British knew how to defend against a siege. The whole city was encircled on the landward side by trenches liberally spiked with abattis, sharpened logs jammed into the earth, points outward. He could smell smoke, different in character from the smell of the ovens or of chimney smoke from the town. A wilder, rougher kind of smoke. But then the wind changed, and the smoke died. There were groans and curses in multiple languages. Evidently the fire had gone out, been extinguished by the English, failed to catch hold in the damp. Who knew? But the abattis remained, and so did the cannon, aiming from the ground between the redoubts. He stared in fascination as they faded slowly into sight. The fog was beginning to shred, and orders were being shouted. The faint skirl of a bagpipe floated on the air. There were Highlanders in the redoubt. The black snouts of the guns poked through the thinning fog, and now there was another kind of smoke that he knew must be slow match, to touch off the cannon. It was time, and his heartbeat echoed in his ears.
You go back. If you want, Reverend.
It was Marion, bending down from his horse, his breath visible in the chilly air.
You aren't sworn nor paid to be here. I'll stay.
He couldn't tell whether he'd said that or only thought it, but Marion straightened up and drew his sword from its scabbard, resting the blade on his thigh. He had a blue tricorne on his head, but there were dewdrops in the puffs of hair that covered his ears. Roger took hold of his borrowed sword, though God knew what he'd do with it. God knew. That was, in fact, a comforting thought, and for a moment he was able to draw a deep breath.
Save your life, maybe,
Lieutenant Montserrat had said, handing it over yesterday,
even if you don't mean to fight. I don't mean to fight. Why am I here? Because they're here.
the men around him, sweating in the chill, smelling death with the scent of fresh-baked bread. There was a roar from the first column that spread over the field, and he was seized by panic.
I don't know what to do.
Mortars nearby fired with a sudden boomph, and he found that his knees and his hands were shaking, and he urgently needed a piss.
You didn't know what to do when the bear killed Amy Higgins,
a voice that might have been his said inside his head.
But you did something anyway. Things would have been worse if I hadn't. I know that much. I have to go.
The first column suddenly began to run, not in tidy lines, but a mob surging toward the redoubt, and the crack of musket fire, yelling their lungs out, some firing, some just running and screaming, a knife in one hand, clawing their way over the abattis. And they were falling as the bullets struck. Those farther out knocked down like bowling pins by bouncing cannonballs. A panicked frog erupted suddenly from a patch of wiry yellow grass near Roger's foot and landed in a puddle where it vanished.
I don't like this, me,
Marion said in a brief moment between explosions. He shook his head.
No, I don't.
He raised his sword.
God be with you, Reverend.
It wasn't God he found with him, but the next best thing. Major Gareth Barnard, one of his father's friends, an ex-military chaplain. Barnard was a tall, long-faced man who wore his greying hair parted down the middle in a way that made him look like an old hound dog. But he'd had a black sense of humour, and he treated Roger, 13 years old, as a man.
Did you ever kill anyone?
He'd asked the Major when they were sat around the table after dinner one night, the old men telling stories of the war.
Yes, the Major replied without hesitation. I'd be no use to my men dead.
What did you do for them?
Roger had asked, curious.
I mean, what does a chaplain do in a battle?
Major Barnard and the Reverend had exchanged a brief look, but the Reverend nodded, and Barnard leaned forward, arms folded on the table in front of him. Roger saw the tattoo on his wrist, a bird of some kind, wings spread over a scroll with something written on it in Latin.
Be with them,
the Major said quietly, but his eyes held Roger's, deeply serious.
Reassure them. Tell them God is with them, that I'm with them, that they aren't alone.
Help them when you can, his father had said softly, eyes on the worn grey oilcloth that covered the table. Hold their hands and pray when you can. He saw, actually saw, the blast of a cannon, a brilliant red flowering spark the size of his head that blinked in the fog with a fireworks boom and then vanished. The fog blew back from the blast, and he saw everything clearly for a second, no more. The black hulk of the gun, round mouth gaping, smoke thicker than the fog rolling over it, fog falling to the ground like water, steam rising from the hot metal to join the roiling fog. The artillerymen swarming over the gun, frenzied blue and brown ants swallowed up the next instant in swirling white. And then the world around him went mad. The shouts of the officers had come with the cannon's blast. He only knew it because he'd been standing close enough to Marion to see his mouth open. But now a general roar went up from the charging men in his column, running hell-bent for the dim shape of the redoubt before him. The sword was in his hand, and he was running, yelling wordless things. Torches glowed faintly in the fog. Soldiers trying to refire the abattis, he thought dimly. Marion was gone. There was a high-pitched yodeling of some sort that might be the general, but might not. The cannon. How many? He couldn't tell, but more than two. The firing kept up at a tremendous rate, the crashing of it shaking his bones every half-minute or so. He made himself stop, bent over, hands on his knees, gasping. He thought he heard musket fire, muffled, rhythmic crashes between the cannon blasts, the British army's disciplined volleys.
Load! Fire! Fall back!
An officer's shout rang out sudden in the heartbeat of silence between one crash and the next.
You're not a soldier. If you get killed, nobody will be here to help them. Fall back, idiot!
He'd been at the back of the rank with Marion, but now he was surrounded by men surging together, pushing, running in all directions. Orders were being barked, and he thought some of the men were struggling to obey. He heard random shouts, saw a black boy who couldn't be more than 12 struggling grimly to load a musket taller than he was. He wore a dark blue uniform, and a bright yellow kerchief showed when the fog parted for an instant. Roger tripped over someone lying on the ground and landed on his knees, brackish water seeping through his breeches. He landed with his hands on the fallen man, and the sudden warmth on his cold fingers was a shock that brought him back to himself. The man moaned, and Roger jerked his hands away, then recovered himself and groped for the man's hand. It was gone, and his own hand was filled with a gush of hot blood that reeked like a slaughterhouse.
"Jesus," he said,
and wiping his hand on his breeches, he grappled with the other in his bag. He had cloths. He yanked out something white and tried to tie it round. He felt frantically for a wrist, but that was gone too. He got a fragment of sleeve and felt his way up it as fast as he could, but he reached the still, solid upper arm a moment after the man died. He could feel the sudden limpness of the body under his hand. He was still kneeling there with the unused cloth in his hand when someone tripped over him and fell headlong with a tremendous splash. Roger got up onto his feet and duck-walked to the fallen man.
"Are you all right?" he shouted, bending forward.
Something whistled over his head and he threw himself flat on top of the man.
"Jesus Christ," the man exclaimed, punching wildly at Roger. "Get the devil off me, you bugger."
They wrestled in the mud and water for a moment, each trying to use the other for leverage to rise, and the cannon kept on firing. Roger pushed the man away and managed to roll up onto his knees in the mud. Cries for help were coming from behind him, and he turned in that direction. The fog was almost gone, driven off by explosions, but the gun smoke drifted white and low across the uneven ground, showing him brief flashes of colour and movement as it shredded.
"Help! Help me!"
He saw the man then, on hands and knees, dragging one leg, and he splashed through the puddles to reach him. Not much blood, but the leg was clearly wounded. He got a shoulder under the man's arm and got him on his feet, hustled him as fast as possible away from the redoubt, out of range. The air shattered again, and the earth seemed to tilt under him. He was lying on the ground with the man he'd been helping on top of him, the man's jaw knocked away, and hot blood and chunks of teeth soaking into his chest. Panicked, he struggled out from under the twitching body. Oh, God, oh, God! He was still alive. And then he was kneeling by the man, slipping in the mud, catching himself with a hand on the chest where he could feel the heart beating in time with the blood spurting.
Oh, Jesus, help me!
He groped for words, frantic. It was all gone. All the comforting words he'd gleaned, all his stock in trade.
"You're not alone,"
he panted, pressing hard on the heaving chest as though he could anchor the man to the earth he was dissolving into.
"I'm here. I won't leave you. It's going to be all right. You're going to be all right."
He kept repeating that, kept his hands pressing hard, and then in the midst of the spouting carnage, felt the life leave the body. Just gone. He sat on his heels, gasping, frozen in place, one hand on the still body as though it were glued there. And then the drums. A faint throb through the rhythmic sounds of gunfire. His bones had absorbed that without his noticing. He could feel the ebb when the first rank of muskets fell back, and the surge when the second rank reached the edge of the redoubt and fired. Something in the back of his head was counting.
1, 2. "What the hell?"
he said thickly, and stood up, shaking his head. There were 3 men near him, 2 still on the ground, the 3rd struggling to rise. He got up and staggered over to them, gave the live man his hand and pulled him up, wordless. One of the others was plainly dead, the other almost so. He let go of the man he was holding and collapsed on his knees by the dying one, taking the man's cold face between his hands, the dark eyes bleared with fear and ebbing blood.
"I'm here,"
he said, though the cannon fired then and his words made no sound. The drums. He heard them clearly now, and a sort of yell, a lot of men shouting together, and then a rumbling, squashing, splashing, and suddenly there were horses everywhere, running. Running at the fucking redoubts, full of guns. A crash of guns, and the cavalry split, half the horses wheeling back and away, the rest scattering, dancing through the fallen men, trying not to step on the bodies, big heads jerking as they fought the reins. He didn't run. He couldn't. He walked forward slowly, swords flopping at his side, stopping where he found a man down. Some he could help with a drink or a hand to press upon a wound, while a friend tied a cloth around it. A word, a blessing where he could. Some were gone, and he laid a hand on them in farewell, and commended their souls to God with a hasty prayer. He found a wounded boy and picked him up, carrying him back through the smoke and puddles away from the cannon. Another roar. The fourth column came running through the broken ground to throw themselves into the fighting at the redoubt. He saw an officer with a flag of some kind run up, shouting, then fall, shot through the head. A little boy, a little black boy in blue and yellow, grabbed the flag, and then bodies hid him from view.
"Jesus Christ," Roger said,
because there wasn't anything else he could possibly say. He could feel the boy's heart beating under his hand through the soaked cloth of his coat. And then it stopped. The cavalry charge had broken altogether. Horses were being ridden or led away, a few of them fallen, huge and dead in the marshy ground or struggling to rise, neighing in panic. An officer in a gaudy uniform was crawling away from a dead horse. Roger set the boy's body down and ran heavily to the officer. Blood was gushing down the man's thigh and his face, and Roger fumbled in his pocket, but there was nothing there. The man doubled up, hands pressing his groin and saying something in a language Roger didn't recognize.
"It's all right," he said to the man, taking him by the arm. "You're going to be all right. I won't leave you." "Bugi Maria, Homush Cheri,"
the man gasped.
"Aye. Right. God be with you."
He turned the man on his side, pulled out his shirt tail and ripped it off, then stuffed it into the man's trousers, pressing into the hot wetness. He leaned on the wound with both hands, and the man screamed. Then there were several cavalrymen there, all talking at once in multiple languages, and they pushed Roger out of the way and picked the wounded officer up bodily, carrying him away. Most of the firing had stopped now. The cannon was silent, but his ears felt as though fire bells were ringing in his head. It hurt. He sat down slowly in the mud and became aware of rain running down his face. He closed his eyes and after some time became aware that a few words had come back to him.
"Out of the depths I cry unto you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice."
The trembling didn't stop, but some little time later he got up and staggered away toward the distant marshes to help bury the dead. Chapter 93. Portrait of a Dead Man. The air still smelled of burning, and the onshore wind in the evening had added a faint stink of death to the usual smell of the marshes. But the battle was over. The Americans defeated. Lord John had turned up in the afternoon, stained with powder smoke, but cheerful, to assure her that it was over and all was well. She didn't think she'd screamed at him, but whatever she'd said had made his face set beneath the mottling of black powder, and he'd squeezed her hand hard and said, "I'll find him," and left. The next day she'd received a note from Lord John, saying simply, "I have walked the entire field with my aides. We have not found him, neither dead nor injured. 100 or so prisoners were taken, and he is not among them. Hal has sent an official inquiry to General Lincoln."
"We have not found him, neither dead nor injured."
She whispered that under her breath over and over throughout the day as a means of keeping herself from going out to comb that bloody field herself, turning over every grain of sand and blade of sawgrass. And in the evening, Lord John had come again, worn and weary, but with a clean face and a smile.
"You said that your husband meant to speak with a Captain Marion. So I went into the American camp with a flag of truce looking for one. He's now a lieutenant colonel, it seems, but he did speak with Roger, and he told me that Roger came off the field with him unhurt and went to help with the burial of the fallen Americans."
Oh, God.
Her knees had given way, and she'd sat down, her feelings in chaos. He isn't dead. He wasn't hurt. And the feeling of relief at that was enormous, but instantly shot through with doubt, questions, and an abiding fear. If he's alive, why isn't he here?
Where? She managed, after a moment. Where did they bury them?
I don't know, Lord John said, his brow creased a little. I'll find out if you like. But I think the burials must surely have been completed by now. There was considerable carnage on the field, but Lieutenant Colonel Maitland thinks there were not above 200 killed. He was commanding the redoubt, he added, seeing her blank look. He cleared his throat.
I think that perhaps, he said diffidently, he might have then gone with the army surgeons to help with the wounded.
Oh. She managed to take a breath that completely filled her lungs, the first one in the last 3 days. Yes, that sounds very reasonable. But why the hell didn't he send me a note? She gathered enough strength to get up and offer Lord John thanks and her hand. He took the hand, drew her in, and embraced her, his arms the first warmth she remembered feeling since Roger had left.
It will be all right, my dear, he said softly,
patted her, and stepped back.
I'm sure it will be all right.
Brianna vacillated between being sure, too, and not being sure at all. But the balance of evidence seemed to indicate that Roger probably was A, alive, and B, reasonably intact. And that semi-conviction was at least enough to let her return to work, seeking to drown her doubt in turpentine. She couldn't decide whether painting Angelina Brumby was more like trying to catch a butterfly without a net, or lying in wait all night by a waterhole, waiting for some shy wild beast to appear for a few seconds, during which you might, if lucky, snap its photo.
"And what I wouldn't give for my Nikon right now," she muttered under her breath.
Today was the first hair day. Angelina had spent nearly 2 hours under the hands of Savannah's most popular hairdresser, emerging at last under a cloud of painstakingly engineered curls and ringlets, these powdered to a fare-thee-well, and further decorated by a dozen or so brilliants stabbed in at random. The whole construction was so vast that it gave the impression that Angelina was carrying about her own personal thunderstorm, complete with lightning flashes. The notion made Brianna smile, and Angelina, who had been looking rather apprehensive, perked up in response.
"Do you like it?"
she asked, hopefully poking gingerly at her head.
"I do," Bree said. "Here, let me."
For Angelina, unable or unwilling to bend her bedizened head enough to look down, was about to collide with the little platform on which the sitter's chair was perched. Once settled, Angelina became her usual self, chatty and distractible, and always in movement, with waving hands, turning heads, widening eyes, constant questions and speculations. But if she was difficult to capture on canvas, she was also charming to watch, and Bree was constantly torn between exasperation and fascination, trying to catch something of the blithe butterfly without having to drive a hairpin through her thorax to make her be still for 5 minutes. She'd had nearly 2 weeks of dealing with Angelina, though, and now set a vase of wax flowers on the table, with firm instructions that Angelina should fix her eyes upon this and count the petals. She then turned over a 2-minute sandglass and urged her subject not to speak or move until the glass ran out. This procedure, repeated at intervals, let her circle Angelina, sketchpad in hand, making rough sketches of the head and neck with quick visual notes of a ringlet coming down the curve of the neck, a deep wave over one of Angelina's shell-pink ears. The morning sun was coming through the window, glowing sweetly through the ear. She wanted to try to catch that pink. There was time, perhaps, to work on the arms and hands. She had as much as she needed of the hair for now, and Angelina was wearing a soft grey silk wrapper that left her arms bare to the elbow.
"Oh, are you painting me now?"
Angelina sat up straighter, wrinkling her nose at the smell of fresh turpentine. "I will be soon," Bree assured her, setting out the palette and brushes. "If you want to stretch for a few minutes, though, this would be a good time." Angelina made her way down to the floor, one hand minding her swaying hair, and the other fanned for balance, and vanished without urging. Brianna could hear her clattering out into the sunshine at the back of the house, calling to Jem and Mandy, who were playing ball in the yard with the little Henderson boy from next door. Bree drew a deep breath, savouring the momentary solitude. There was a strong touch of fall in the air, though the sun was bright through the window, and a single late bumblebee hummed slowly in, circled the disappointing wax flowers, and bumbled out again. It would be winter soon in the mountains. She felt a pang of longing for the high rocks and the clean scent of balsam fir, snow, and mud, the close warm smell of sheltered animals. Much more for her parents, for the sense of her family all about her. Moved by impulse, she turned the page of her sketchbook and tried to capture a glimpse of her father's face. Just a line or two in profile, the straight long nose and the strong brow, and the small curved line that suggested his smile hidden in the corner of his mouth. That was enough for now. With a comforting sense of his presence near her, she opened the box where she kept the small lead-foil tubes she had made, the ends folded over to close them, and the little pots of hand-ground pigment, and made up her simple palette. Lead white, a touch of lamp black, and a dab of madder lake. A moment's hesitation, and she added a thin line of lead tin yellow and a spot of smalt, the nearest thing she could get so far, she thought with determination, to cobalt. With a colour of shadows in her mind, she went across to the small collection of canvases leaning against the wall, and uncovering the unfinished portrait of Jane, set it on the table where it would catch the morning light. "That's the trouble," she murmured. "Maybe." The light. She'd done it with an imagined light source, falling from the right so as to throw the delicate jawline into relief. But what she hadn't thought to imagine was what kind of light it was. The shadows cast by a morning light sometimes had a faint green tinge, while those of midday were dusky, a slight browning of the natural skin tones, and evening shadows were blue and grey and sometimes a deep lavender. But what time of day suited the mysterious Jane? She frowned at the portrait, trying to feel the girl, know something of her through Fanny's words, her emotions. She was a prostitute, Fanny had said. Her original drawing had been made by one of the customers at the brothel. Surely, then, it had been made at night. Firelight, then, or candlelight? Her ruminations were interrupted by the sound of Angelina's laughter and footsteps in the hallway. A man's voice, amused. Mr. Brumby. And what's he thinking just now? Is he pleased about the battle or dismayed?
"Mr. Solomon is in my office, Henrika," he was saying over his shoulder as he came in. "Take him something to eat, would you? Ah, Mrs. Mackenzie, a very good morning to you, ma'am."
Alfred Brumby paused in the doorway, smiling in at her. Angelina clung to his arm, beaming up at him and shedding white powder on the sleeve of his bottle-green coat, but he didn't appear to notice.
"And how is the work proceeding, might I ask?"
He was courteous enough to make it sound as though he really was asking permission to inquire rather than demanding a progress report.
"Very well, sir," Bree said,
and stepped back, gesturing so he could come in and see the head sketches that she'd done so far, arranged in fans on the table. Angelina's complete head and neck from multiple angles, close view of hairline, side and front, assorted small details of ringlets, waves and brilliance.
"Beautiful, beautiful," he exclaimed.
He bent over them, taking a quizzing glass from his pocket and using it to examine the drawings.
"She's captured you exactly, my dear. A thing I shouldn't have thought possible without the use of leg irons, I confess."
"Mr. Brumby," Angelina swatted at him, but laughed, flushing like a June rose.
"Lord, that colour."
But there was no chance of it lasting long enough to study. She'd just have to fix it in mind and try later. She cast a longing glance at the tempting dab of madder on her fresh palette. Mr. Brumby had a due regard for his own time, though, and thus for hers as well, and after a few more flattering remarks, he kissed his wife's hand and left to meet Mr. Solomon, leaving Angelina still an enchanting shade of pink. "Sit down," Bree said hastily, offering a hand. "Let's see how much we can get done before our elevenses." The awe of actual oil paints, perhaps aided by the fumes of turpentine and linseed oil, seemed to calm Angelina, and while she sat with unusual rigidity, it didn't really matter at the moment. And the studio was temporarily filled with a peaceful silence made up of small noises, children outside, dogs scratching and snuffling, muffled pot banging and talk from the cookhouse, a thump of feet and murmur of voices overhead as the maids swept out the halves, emptied the chamber pots and aired the linens, the jingle and clop of wagons passing in the street. A single distant boom came in on the breeze from the window, and she stiffened for a moment, but as nothing further happened, she relaxed back into the work, though now with the thought of Roger hovering over her left shoulder, watching her paint. She imagined for a moment his arm about her waist and the hairs on the back of her neck prickled in anticipation of warm breath. The mantelpiece clock in the drawing room down the hall struck 11 in an imperious chime, and Bree felt her stomach gurgle in anticipation. Breakfast had been at 6, and she could do with a slice of cake and a cup of tea.
"Ooh,
Mrs. Brumby said, moving her lips as little as possible, just in case. "No, you can talk," Brianna assured her, suppressing a smile. "Don't move your hands, though."
"Oh, of course."
The hand that had risen unconsciously to fiddle with her densely sculpted curl dropped like a stone into her lap. But then she giggled.
"Must I have Henrika feed me my elevenses? I hear her coming."
Henrika weighed about 14 stone and could be heard coming for some considerable time before she appeared, the wooden heels of her shoes striking the bare floorboards of the hall with a measured tread like the thump of a bass drum.
"I have got to paint that floor cloth you asked for," Bree said, not realizing that she'd spoken aloud until Angelina laughed. "Oh, do," she said. "I meant to tell you. Mr. Brumby says he prefers the design with the pineapples, and could you possibly have it ready by Wednesday week? He wants to have a great dinner for General Prevost and his officers, in gratitude, you know, for his gallant defence of the city."
She hesitated, her little pink tongue darting out to touch her lips.
"Do you think, I don't wish to be, that is..."
Brianna made a long, slow brushstroke, a streak of pale pink mingled with cream, catching the shine of light on the roundness of Angelina's delicate forearm. "It's all right," she said, barely attending. "Don't move your fingers."
"No, no,"
Angelina said, twitching her fingers guiltily, then trying to remember how they'd been.
"That's fine. Don't move."
Angelina froze, and Bree managed a grey suggestion of shadow between the fingers while Henrika clamped in. To her surprise, though, there was no sound of rattling coffee things, nor any hint of the cake she'd smelled baking this morning as she dressed.
"What is it, Henrika?"
Angelina was still sitting rigidly erect, a and while she'd been given permission to talk, she kept her eyes fixed on the vase of flowers.
Where is our morning coffee?
Da ist ein Mann,
Henrika informed her mistress portentously, dropping her voice as though to avoid being overheard.
Someone at the door, you mean?
Angelina risked a curious glance at the studio door before jerking her eyes back into line.
What sort of man?
Henrika pursed her lips and nodded at Brianna.
Ein Soldat. Er will sie sehen.
A soldier?
Angelina dropped her pose and looked at Brianna in astonishment.
And he wants to see Mrs. Mackenzie? You're sure of that, Henrika? You don't think he might want Mr. Brumby?
Henrika was fond of her young mistress and refrained from rolling her eyes, instead merely nodding again at Bree.
Her, she said. Er sagte die, Lady Painter.
She folded her hands under her apron and waited with patience for further instructions.
Oh.
Angelina was clearly at a loss, and just as clearly had lost all sense of her pose. Shall I go and talk to him? Bree inquired. She swished her squirrel fur brush in the turps and wrapped it in a bit of damp rag.
Oh, no. Bring him here, will you, Henrika?
Angelina plainly wanted to know what this visitation was about. And, Bree thought, with an internal smile, seeing Angelina poke hastily at her hair, be seen in the thrilling position of having her portrait painted. The soldier in question proved to be a very young man, in the uniform of the Continental Army. Angelina gasped at sight of him and dropped the glove she was holding in her left hand.
"Who are you, sir?"
she demanded, sitting up as straight as she possibly could.
"And how come you are here, may I ask?"
"I came under flag of truce to bring a message. Lieutenant Hansen, your servant, ma'am,"
the young man replied, bowing.
"And yours, ma'am,"
turning to Brianna. He withdrew a sealed note from the bosom of his coat and bowed to her.
"If I may take the liberty of inquiring, are you Mrs. Roger Mackenzie?"
She felt as though she'd been dropped abruptly down a glacial abyss, freezing cold and ice-blind. Confused memories of yellow telegrams seen in war movies, the memory of siege guns, and...
"Where is Roger?"
"I am," she croaked.
Angelina and Henrika both looked at her, grasped the situation at once, and Angelina rushed to support her.
"What had happened?"
Angelina demanded fiercely, hugging Bree round the middle and glaring at the soldier.
"Tell us at once."
Henrika's hands tightened on Bree's shoulders, and she could hear the whisper of a German prayer behind her.
"Mein Gott, erlöse uns vom Bösen."
The young man. He couldn't be more than 16, Bree thought dimly, looked flabbergasted. Bree got control of her throat muscles and swallowed.
"Has he been killed in battle?" she asked with what calm she could muster. "Oh, God, I can't tell the kids. I can't do this. Oh, God."
"Well, yes, ma'am," the soldier said, blinking. "But how did you know?"
The note was still in his hand, half extended. She broke free of the women and snatched it from him, scrabbling frantically to break the seal. For a moment, the words, written in an unfamiliar hand, swam before her eyes and her gaze dropped to the signature.
"A doctor, dear God."
And then her eyes rose to the salutation. "Friend Mackenzie."
"What?"
she said, looking up at the young soldier. "Who the hell wrote this?"
"Why, Dr. Wallace, ma'am,"
he said, shocked by her language. Then, realizing, "Oh, he's a Quaker, ma'am." She wasn't paying attention, though, having returned to the text of the letter.
"Thy husband bids me give thee his best and tell thee that he will be with thee in Savannah in 3 days' time, God willing."
She closed her eyes and took a breath so deep that it dizzied her. He would have written to say so in his own hand, but has suffered a minor dislocation of the thumb, which prevents his writing comfortably. He has departed on a brief but urgent errand for Lieutenant Colonel Marion.
In the meantime, he asked whether thee would come to the American camp at Savannah. The soldier who brings this under a flag of truce will escort thee, in order to perform an artistic service of generosity and compassion. One of the most esteemed of the American cavalry commanders was killed in the battle, and General Lincoln is desirous of having some concrete memento of General Pulaski. Friend Roger offered consolation to the general's friends, and upon hearing General Lincoln's lamentation at having no lasting memorial, suggested that as thee were close at hand, thee might be willing to come and make a drawing of the gentleman prior to his burial. At this point, astonishment began to overcome shock, and she started to breathe more slowly. She was still light-headed, and her heart was fluttering. She put a hand flat on her chest in reflex, but the words on the page had steadied. Pulaski. The name was vaguely familiar to her. She must have heard it in school. One of the European volunteers who had come to join the American cause. There was something in New York named after him, wasn't there? And now, today, not 200 years in the past, he had died. She became aware of Angelina, Henrika, and the young soldier all staring at her with varying degrees of concern and anxiety. "It's all right," she said. Her voice trembled, and she cleared her throat and shook her head to dispel the dizziness. "It's all right," she said again, more firmly. "My husband's all right."
"Oh."
Angelina's face relaxed, and she clasped her hands.
"Oh, I'm so glad, Mrs. Mackenzie."
Behind Angelina's back, Henrika crossed herself solemnly, the fear ebbing from her eyes. The soldier coughed.
"Yes, ma'am," he said apologetically. "I should have said straight out, only I never thought."
"It's all right," Bree said. Her hands were damp, and she picked up a relatively clean rag to dry them, then folded the note carefully and tucked it into her pocket. Her heart was slowing, and her brain was starting to work again.
"Mrs. Brumby, Angelina, I need to go with this gentleman. Just for a few hours," she added quickly, seeing anxiety bloom again in Angelina's big brown eyes.
"It's a request from my husband, something urgent that I have to do for him. But I'll come back as quickly as ever I can. Do you think perhaps the children?" She looked apologetically at Henrika, but the housekeeper nodded vigorously.
"Yeah, I will mind them. I..."
The clank of the brass door knocker interrupted her, and she turned sharply.
"Ach, mein Gott!"
She moved off with determination, muttering something under her breath that Brianna couldn't interpret, but assumed it to be along the lines of, "If it isn't one damn thing, it's another."
"I'll have cook pack you some food. And will Mrs. Mackenzie need a horse?"
Angelina turned sharply to the young soldier, who blushed.
"I've brought a good riding mule for the lady, ma'am," he said. It's not a great distance to the camp."
"The camp?" Angelina said blankly, interrupted in her mental preparations.
"To the American camp? Surely you don't mean behind the siege lines?"
"Well, this could get sticky."
"It's a matter of friendship, Angelina," Bree said firmly. "My husband is a minister. He knows a lot of people on both sides of this war. And it's a friend of his, a surgeon named Dr. Wallace, who asked for me to come."
"Dr. Wallace? Oh, you don't mean the Dr. Wallace who operated on the governor?"
Angelina was round-eyed by this time, alarmed but excited by the sense of emergency.
"Possibly," Brianna said, taken aback. "I haven't met him yet. I'm sure that..."
"I wish to speak with Mrs. Mackenzie," a deep male voice said from somewhere down the corridor. "My friend wishes to engage her for a portrait. Lord John Grey recommended that we call upon her, a mutual acquaintance. Please inform her that I have brought her a letter of introduction and..."
"Mein Gott," Brianna said under her breath. "John Grey? What on earth?"
The gentleman, his voice was English, educated, was encountering resistance from Henrika.
Brianna was already picking up pencils, charcoal sticks, shuffling together a box of things she might need to make the image of a dead man. There wasn't time. Angelina, she said over her shoulder, could you maybe tell this man that I've been called away on an urgent errand? He can come back tomorrow, or maybe the next day, she added doubtfully. No telling how long it might take. Of course. Angelina headed purposefully for the hall, and Brianna closed her eyes and tried to think. The kids first. At least she could tell them that Daddy was coming to see them soon. Then, what on earth to wear for a commission of this sort? It would have to be her rough painting gown for riding a mule, and whatever the conditions might be in a siege camp. Would they have trenches? She wondered. The voices in the hallway had risen, and there were more of them. Angelina and Henrika were arguing with what sounded like two men now, both of whom seemed set upon seeing Mrs. Mackenzie come hell or high water. There wasn't time for this. Impatient, she stepped out into the hall, intending to send the visitors on their way. The morning sun flooded in through the open front door, silhouetting what seemed like a mob of shadow people, black bodies, faceless heads, limbs outlined in sparking light as they moved. It was one of those sudden, beautiful sights that happen without warning, and she paused for a single heartbeat to fix it in her mind. Then one of the taller figures moved, turning, and she saw in outline the same long, straight nose, the same high brow that her fingers had drawn so recently. Wait, she said. She had no memory of striding down the hall, but was suddenly face to face with him, and there was no more obscuring shadow, but morning sun, lighting a shockingly familiar pair of blue and slanted eyes fixed on hers. Bloody hell, he said, completely startled. It's you.
Your brother!
Angelina was excited beyond all bearing.
And you didn't know he was here, nor he you? How amazing!
Yes, Bree said. Yes, amazing. In a daze, she extended a tentative hand toward him. William blinked once, grasped the hand, and bowed over it, kissing it lightly. The feel of his breath on her turpentine-chilled hand raised the hairs on her forearm, and she tightened her fingers on his. He straightened up, but didn't pull away. His fingers turned and covered hers.
I didn't mean to disturb you, he said.
And she could see and feel his eyes searching her face, just the way she was searching his. Oh, not at all, she said, meaning quite the opposite. He caught that, smiled a little, and let go of her hand.
Did you say that Lord John sent you?
Yes, he did, the conniving old sod.
Begging your pardon, ma'am.
He took his gaze off her for a moment, turning toward the other gentleman. This was a tall, very broad young man of mixed blood with a remarkable cap of close-cropped tight curls of a soft reddish-brown.
Allow me to present my friend, Mr. John Cinnamon, William said.
Angelina and Henrika curtsied immediately in a bloom of skirts. Mr. Cinnamon looked quite horrified, but after a quick glance at William, he bowed deeply and murmured,
Your most obedient servant, ma'am, and, ma'am?
Ma'am, Mrs. Mackenzie. Lieutenant Hanson, quite eclipsed by William and Mr. Cinnamon, who were each a good foot taller than he was, struggled manfully to regain Brianna's attention.
We must be going, ma'am, or we shan't arrive in time for you to, do it.
He cleared his throat.
And who are you, may I ask?
William was frowning at the lieutenant's blue and buff uniform.
What on earth are you doing here?
Bree cleared her own throat loudly. Lieutenant Hanson came to fetch me for an urgent commission, she said. He's right. We need to leave as soon as I've packed my things and changed clothes. Told the children. Will you come with me, back to my studio. We can talk while I put things together.
By unspoken consensus, William came alone, leaving his friend and Lieutenant Hansen to the tender mercies of Angelina and Henrika, who were already twittering about cakes, coffee, and perhaps slices of cold ham. Brianna's stomach gurgled at the thought of ham sandwiches, but she suppressed it for the moment and turned to William.
My brother.
I wanted to tell you, she said at once, closing the door and standing with her back against it, when we first met. Do you remember? On the quay in Wilmington. Roger, my husband, was with me, and Jem and Mandy. That was... I wanted you to meet them, see them, even if you didn't know we were yours. He looked away and put a hand on the table, touching the wood only with his fingertips. She felt the solid door against her shoulder blades and understood the need of physical support. Mine? He said softly, looking down at the scatter of papers and brushes on the table. I should probably say something polite about only if you want us, she said, but it's
a bit late for that,
he finished, and looked up at her, his eyes wary but direct. To lie about the truth, I mean. His mouth turned up a little at one side, but she wasn't sure it was a smile.
Particularly when it's as plain as the nose on your face. And mine.
She touched her own nose by reflex and laughed, a little nervously. His nose was hers, and the eyes too. He was tan, though, with dark chestnut hair clubbed in a queue, and while his face was very like her, their father's, his mouth had come from somewhere else. Well, I do apologize, though, for not telling you. He looked at her, expressionless, for the space of four heartbeats. She felt each small thud distinctly.
I accept your apology, he said dryly, though in all honesty, I'm glad you didn't tell me.
He paused, then, apparently thinking this might sound ungracious, added,
I wouldn't have known how to respond to such a revelation at the time.
And you do now?
No, I bloody don't, he said frankly. But as my uncle recently pointed out, at least I haven't blown my brains out. When I was 17, I might have.
A hot flush rose in her cheeks. He wasn't joking. How flattering, she said. And to avoid looking at him, she turned and resumed the ordering of her sketchbox. She heard him snort a little under his breath, and then his footsteps close behind her.
I apologize. He said quietly. I didn't mean that with any derogatory reference to you or your family.
Your family, you mean? She said, not turning round. The silver point pencil? No. Charcoal and graphite. Silver point was too delicate for this. He cleared his throat.
I meant it solely with regard to my own situation, he said formally,
which has nothing whatever to do with... He stopped abruptly. She swung around to look at him and found him staring at the portrait of Jane, propped against the wall, as though he had quite literally seen a ghost. He'd gone pale under his tan, and his hands were half clenched.
Where did you get that? He said.
His voice was hoarse, and he cleared his throat violently.
That picture. That girl.
I made it, she said simply. For Fanny. He closed his eyes for an instant, then opened them, still fixed on the painting. He turned away, though, and she caught the bob of his Adam's apple as he swallowed hard.
Fanny, he said. Francis. You know her, then? Where is she? How is she?
She's fine, Bree said firmly, and crossing the few feet of floor between them, laid a hand on his arm.
She's with my parents, in North Carolina. You've seen her?
Yes, of course. Though actually I haven't seen her since early September. We stopped for a bit in Charlestown, she corrected, to visit my, well, I suppose he's my stepbrother, and Masali. Well, she's sort of my stepsister, but they're not exactly. The wariness had come back into William's eyes. He didn't pull away from her, though, and she felt the warmth of his arm through the cloth of his coat.
"Are these people also my relations?" he asked, as though fearing the answer might be yes.
"I suppose so. Da adopted Fergus. He's French, but, well, that doesn't matter. He was an orphan in Paris. Then later Da married. Well, that doesn't matter either. But Masali, she's Fergus's wife, and her sister Joan, they're Da's stepdaughters, so, And Fergus and Masali's children. They have 5 now, so they'd be..."
William took a step back, detaching himself, and put up a hand. "Enough," he said firmly. He pointed a long forefinger at her. "You, I can deal with. Nothing else. Not today." She laughed and picked up the ratty shawl she kept in the studio for work during the chilly hours of the morning. "Not today," she agreed. "I have to go, William. Shall we?" "Your commission," he said, and shook his head as though to settle his wits. "What is it?"
"Well, if you must know, I'm going to the American siege camp to draw pictures of a dead cavalry commander."
He blinked, and then she saw his eyes lift, his gaze going to the portrait of Jane. The sun had moved, and the picture stood in shadow. She stopped, shawl halfway around her shoulders, startled by the look on his face. It lasted no more than a moment, though, and then he turned and picked up her sketchbox, tucking it under his arm.
"Are portraits of the dead a speciality of yours?" he asked with a slight edge.
"Not yet," she replied with an equal edge. "Give me my sketchbox."
"I'll carry it," he said, and reached to open the door for her.
"I'm coming with you." Chapter 94. Outriders. The fog off the river had finally lifted, and the sun was warm. To her relief, the mule Lieutenant Hansen had brought for her was tall and rangy, raw-boned and rabbit-eared, but of a friendly disposition. She had visions of herself riding a wizened donkey, her feet dragging in the dust, surrounded by large men on big horses towering above her. As it was, William and John Cinnamon both possessed sound but unremarkable geldings, and the lieutenant himself rode another, smaller mule. The lieutenant wasn't happy.
"I am not allowing my sister to go unaccompanied into an army camp," William had said firmly, untethering his own horse outside the Brumbies' house.
"Maybe," Mr. Cinnamon said, and bent to give Brianna a foot up into her saddle.
"But I will be escorting her. General Lincoln is expecting me to bring him, Mrs. Mackenzie."
"And Mrs. Mackenzie he will get," she assured the lieutenant, settling her skirts and taking up the reins, though apparently without riders. Lieutenant Hansen had given William a look of deep suspicion. No wonder, she thought. William sat tall and easy in the saddle and wore a shabby, travel-stained suit that hadn't been fashionable to start with. But someone with much less experience than Lieutenant Hansen would have recognized him at a glance as a soldier. And not only a soldier, an officer accustomed to command. The fact that William's accent and bearing were at odds with his very commonplace dress was probably even more upsetting. The lieutenant's thoughts were clear to her, and she thought, probably to William too, though his face was politely impassive. Was he a British soldier in mufti? A spy? Was he a British soldier looking to turn his coat and take up a commission with the Continentals? She saw Mr. Hansen's gaze dart to the bulk of John Cinnamon and away.
And what about him?
But there was no choice. Lieutenant Hansen had been sent to fetch an artist and couldn't well come back without her. Shoulders hunched round his ears, he turned his mule's head toward White Bluff Road.
"Tell me about General Pulaski," Brianna suggested, coming up beside him.
"It was only this morning that he was killed."
No, ma'am. That is to say,"
Hansen said, obviously striving for exactness.
"He did die this morning on the ship, but he..."
"What ship?" she asked, startled.
"The Wasp, I think it's called."
Hansen cast a quick look over his shoulder and lowered his voice. The general was shot up 2 days ago, running his cavalry in betwixt two batteries, but...
He led a cavalry charge into cannon?
Evidently, Lieutenant Hansen hadn't lowered his voice quite enough, for the question came from William, riding close behind. He sounded incredulous and slightly amused. Ambree turned round and glared at him. He ignored the glare, but urged his horse up toward Hansen's mule. The lieutenant was carrying his flag of truce, and at this moved it instinctively, pointing it at William in the manner of a jousting lance.
I meant no insult to the general, William said mildly, raising one hand in negligent defence. It sounds a most dashing and courageous manoeuvre.
It was, Hansen replied shortly. He raised his flag a little and turned his back on William, leaving brother and sister riding side by side, John Cinnamon bringing up the rear. Bree gave William a narrow-eyed look that strongly suggested he should keep his mouth shut. He eyed her for a moment, then looked away with a patently bland countenance. She wanted to laugh almost as much as she wanted to poke him with something sharp, but lacking her own flag of truce, she settled for an audible snort.
A vous suis, Mr. Cinnamon said politely behind her.
Merci, she said with equal politeness. William snorted.
A tes amours,
Mr. Cinnamon said, sounding amused. Nothing more was said until they arrived a few minutes later at the edge of the city. A detachment of Scottish Highlanders was guarding the end of the street, even though the street itself was guarded by a couple of large redoubts dug by the British, visible on the side toward the river. The sight of the kilted soldiers, and the sound of their voices speaking Gaelic to one another, gave her a peculiar twisting sensation inside. A camp kettle was boiling over a tiny fire, and the scent of coffee and toasted bread made her mouth water. It was a long time since breakfast, and in the haste of leaving, they'd left behind Henrika's packet of food. She must have been gazing hungrily at a few men eating by the fire, for William nudged his horse nearer and murmured, I'll see you're fed as soon as we reach the camp. She glanced at him and nodded thanks. There was nothing amused or offhand in his manner now. He sat relaxed in his saddle, reins loose in his hand as Lieutenant Hansen talked to the Scottish officer in command, but his eyes never left the soldiers. They passed through the checkpoint in silence. She could feel the eyes of the soldiers on her skin and the hair prickled on her scalp. The enemy. The American siege lines lay no more than a quarter of a mile away, the camp perhaps half a mile beyond, but Lieutenant Hansen led them immediately inland in order to circle the American redoubts and the French artillery dragged overland from the ships. The guns were silent, thank God, but she could see them plainly, dark shapes beginning to emerge from the morning's fog, still thick here near the river. You were telling me about General Pulaski, she said, pushing up beside the lieutenant. She didn't want to look at the cannon and think of Jem and Mandy in the city, or the holes and burnt roofs she'd seen in the houses of Savannah nearest the river. He was on a ship, you said? The lieutenant had relaxed a little, once out of Savannah, and was pleased to tell her of the dreadful but gallant death of Casimir Pulaski. Yes, ma'am. 'Twas the Wasp, as I said. When the general went down, his men got him back directly, of course, but 'twas plain he was bad hurt. Dr. Liner, he's the camp surgeon, ma'am, took the grape shot out of him, but then General Pulaski said as how he wanted to go aboard ship. I don't know why. Because the French aren't going to hang about much longer, William interrupted. It's hurricane season. D'Estaing will be nervous. I imagine Pulaski knew that too and didn't want to risk being left behind, wounded if, when, I mean, the Americans abandoned the siege. Hansen turned in his saddle, pale with rage. And what would you know of such matters, you dandy prat? William looked at him as he might regard a humming mosquito, but answered politely enough. I have eyes, sir, he said, and if I understand aright, General Pulaski was the commander of horse for the entire American army. Is that right?
It is,
Hanson replied between gritted teeth. So what? Even Bree could tell that this was purely rhetorical, and William merely lifted one shoulder in a shrug.
I want to hear about the general's cavalry charge, John Cinnamon said, interested. I'm sure he must have had a good reason, he added tactfully.
But why did he do that?
Yes, I'd like to hear that too, Bree put in hastily.
Lieutenant Hanson glared at William and John Cinnamon, but after a muttered remark in which she caught only the words, fine pair of backgammon players, he stiffened his shoulders and fell back a little so that Brianna could ride up alongside him on the narrow road. The countryside here was flat and open, but the earth was sandy and thickly grown with a sort of coarse, rough-edged grass that caught at the horse's feet. She could see that the road, though, had been heavily used of late. Hoofprints, footprints, horse droppings, wagon wheels. The road was churned and muddy, the verges trodden down by marching troops, moving fast. A sudden shiver went up her back as the wind changed, and she caught the scent of the army. A feral smell of sweat and flesh, metal and grease, tinged with the stink of lye soap, manure, half-burnt food, and gunpowder. Mr. Hanson had relaxed a little, seeing that he had his audience's full attention, and was explaining that the Americans and their French allies had planned and executed an assault on the British forces at the Spring Hill Redoubt. You can see that from here, ma'am, pointing toward the sea. As part of that assault, General Pulaski's cavalry was to follow the initial infantry attack, so as to cause confusion, do you see, amongst the enemy? The cavalry charge had evidently accomplished that modest goal, but the overall attack had failed, and Pulaski himself had been cut down when caught in the crossfire between two British batteries.
A great pity, William said, with no sense of sarcasm whatever.
Lieutenant Hanson glanced at him, but accepted the remark with a brief nod.
It was. I heard that the Wasp's captain meant to bury the general at sea, but one of his friends who'd gone aboard with him said no, they mustn't, and came ashore with his body just after dawn this morning in a longboat.
Why would his friend not want him to be buried at sea? She asked, careful not to imply any criticism with the question.
His men, William said, before Lieutenant Hanson could answer.
He spoke with a sober certainty.
He's their commander. They'll need to bid him farewell. Properly.
The lieutenant had risen slightly in his stirrups, ready to be indignant at the interruption, but hearing this subsided and gave Brianna a brief bow.
Just so, ma'am, he said.
Past the artillery, they wound their way through an acre or so of mud-spattered tents and soldiers, the air around them a strange combination of sea tang, the acrid ghost of gunpowder, and a breath of autumn rot from the harvested fields beyond. Brianna took a deep, inquisitive breath and let it out hastily.
Latrine trenches.
They were headed toward a cluster of large tents. This must be General Lincoln's field headquarters, that billowed and moved gently in the morning air, like a group of friends with their heads together talking. This pleasant illusion was shattered in the next instant as a battery of cannon went off behind them. Brianna started and jerked at the reins. Her mule, evidently used to this kind of thing, jerked impatiently back with a toss of his head. Lieutenant Hanson's mule and the horses were less phlegmatic about the noise and shied violently, nostrils flaring.
"Getting rather a late start this morning, aren't you?" William said to Hanson, bringing his horse round in a circle to calm it.
"And who taught you to ride, brother?" she thought, seeing him.
Lord John was a good horseman, but Jamie Fraser had been a groom at the estate where William had grown up.
"The fog," Hanson replied shortly. "Cannon fire disperses it."
He turned his mule's head toward one of the large tents.
"Come, you're to see Captain Pinckney."
She found herself next to William as they resumed their plodding advance, and leaned close to speak to him quietly.
"You said they'd left it late. The artillery firing, you meant?"
"Yes."
He glanced at her, one dark eyebrow raised.
"You needn't worry. It's only a gesture."
"I wasn't," she began, but stopped. She was worried, worried that perhaps her father had been mistaken, that the siege would continue.
Well, all right, I was, she conceded.
What do you mean, a gesture?
They've lost,
William said with a quick glance toward Lieutenant Hansen. But they haven't lifted the siege officially. Likely General Lincoln is arguing with D'Estaing about it.
She stared at him. You seem to know a bloody lot about it for a guy who just rode into town.
A guy?
The brow flicked higher but relaxed as he dismissed this.
I was a soldier, you know, and I know what a military camp feels like, what it should feel like. This one is...
He lifted a hand toward the ragged rows of tents.
They aren't admitting it, hence the bombardment, but... Tighten your rein, it's coming again.
It did. Another volley of defiant artillery, but the mules and horses merely danced and snorted this time, not taken by surprise. But, she said, neatly returning to her place at his side, he gave her a sidelong smile.
But they know the end is coming, he finished. But as for my knowledge of the situation, I will admit it's more than observation.
A brief, fierce grimace crossed his face and disappeared.
Lord John told me about the battle. He wasn't in any doubt as to the outcome, nor am I.
So the siege is about to lift, she persisted, wanting certainty.
Yes.
Oh, good, she said, and let her shoulders slump in relief. He gave her an odd, interested look, but said no more and urged his horse into a faster walk. Captain Pinckney was perhaps 30 and probably good-looking, though sleeplessness and defeat had made him haggard. He blinked as Bree alighted from her mule without assistance and turned to greet him. She topped him by 4 or 5 inches. He closed his eyes for an instant, opened them again, and bowed to her with impeccable courtesy.
You're most obedient, Mrs. Mackenzie, and I am to give you the utmost compliments of General Lincoln and the troops. I'm also to convey his deep sense of obligation and gratitude for your kind assistance.
He spoke like an Englishman, though she thought there was a sudden softness in his vowels. She didn't try to curtsy, but bowed to him in return. I'm very glad to help, she said. I understand there may be some urgency in the, situation. Perhaps you could show me where General Pulaski is at the moment? Captain Pinckney glanced at William and John Cinnamon, who had dismounted and handed their reins to the orderly accompanying the captain.
William Ransom, sir, your servant.
William bowed, and straightening, nodded at Cinnamon.
My friend and I have come to escort my sister. We will remain and see her back when her errand is finished.
Your sister? Oh, good. Captain Pinckney looked substantially happier at the revelation that he wouldn't be solely responsible for her.
Your servant, sir. Follow me.
The guns went off again, a ragged volley. This time she didn't jump. The dead general lay in a small, worn green tent on the river bank, apart from the camp. This placement might have been a sign of respect. But there was a practical aspect to it, too, as Brianna discovered, when Captain Pinckney removed a crumpled but clean handkerchief from his sleeve and handed it to her before courteously raising the tent flap for her.
Thank you. Oh, my God.
A few late flies rose sluggishly from the corpse, wafting on a rising stink that shrouded him more thoroughly than the clean sheet over his face and upper body.
Gangrene, William said behind her under his breath. Jesus.
John Cinnamon coughed heavily once and fell silent.
I do apologize, Mrs. Mackenzie, Pinckney was saying.
He'd taken hold of her elbows, afraid.